the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Today, we're bringing you the truth, a perspective on climate crisis news that you generally don't get on mainstream media. So the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, A-M-O-C, might be on the brink of collapse. According to a recent study published in the journal Nature Climate Change, the AMOC is the weakest it has been in more than 1,000 years. A collapse would unleash rising sea levels along the coasts of North America and northwestern Europe and usher in more extreme weather, such as heat waves and cyclones. Actually, you know, that's actually putting it mildly. The collapse of AMOC could be devastating. In addition to making our weather more extreme, it could upend agricultural practices, biodiversity, and economic stability across the vast areas of the world that AMOC influences. So you're probably wondering, what is AMOC and why is it important? Well, also known as the Gulf Stream, AMOC is a large system of ocean currents that transports warm water from the tropics northwards into the North Atlantic. As Live Science explains, quote, the current begins near the Florida Peninsula, carrying warm surface water north toward Newfoundland before meandering east across the Atlantic. By the time it reaches the North Atlantic, that warm surface water becomes cooler, saltier, and denser, sinking into the deep sea before being driven south again, where the cycle repeats, end quote.
So it's almost like this is how the Atlantic Ocean works. I mean, this Absolutely. Is how the Atlantic Ocean moves. And
it's a conveyor belt.
Vital to the ecosystem of the ocean, vital to the climate of the countries, anywhere in the whole North Atlantic region. I mean, anywhere Absolutely. In the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator, they're going to be hugely affected by mm-hmm. the AMOC. And why it's like this temperature, why it's generally temperate in Britain and generally hot in the tropics is because of AMOC working.
That's right.
Okay. So this movement, so again, quoting from Life Science, this movement of water, quote, has myriad climate impacts on both sides of the Atlantic, keeping temperatures in Florida and the UK mild, influencing the path and strength of cyclones, and helping to regulate sea levels, end quote. In other words, it is a stabilizing force for Earth's weather and has been for thousands of years. In our first show, we presented a lot of climate news and it was all pretty grim. And we presented that news because Extinction Rebellion's mandate is to tell the truth about our climate crisis. But we also presented grim news because it is truly the ultimate measure of whether or not the climate policies our politicians propose are worth a damn. If their policies do not help us avoid reaching the climate tipping point of Gulf Stream collapse, then they are extinction policies. If they are not able to prevent an AMOC collapse, then they are extinction policies. Guess what, though? This news about the Gulf Stream and other catastrophes are also the true measure of whether or not your climate rebellion is worth a damn. If your activism does not help us avoid reaching climate tipping point of Gulf Stream collapse and all the devastation that that would produce, then you are practicing extinction activism. The time for business as usual organizing is long gone.
Long gone, people. You know, those of us who are well informed about the climate crisis are constantly frustrated by the news media coverage. That's one of the motivations for this show. Extinction Rebellion complains about news media a lot and how they're not telling the truth. And the media will have to answer for that. But there's a problem with many of the scientists who get quoted in the news media. This next thing is going to be controversial, but I'm going to say it because it's what I think. Years from now, we're going to be talking about the failure of science. We're going to be talking about the failure of every level of society to prevent preventable catastrophe. And we're going to blame the fossil fuel companies and the politicians and the news media. And of course, we should. But we're also going to be talking about the failure of science, particularly of climatologists, to tell the public what they know. It's not coming through. It's not getting conveyed. The broader public is not learning the situation. Media obfuscation is a huge part of that. But part of the responsibility lies with the climatologists themselves. Now, maybe it's that the news media, even the mainstream media, picks those scientists who aren't clear and ignores the scientists who are clear. Or maybe the media picks the quotations that are harder to understand and doesn't use the quotations that are more plain language. Maybe there's some of that going on. But for whatever reason, in daily coverage of the climate crisis, the scientists aren't being clear. They can't make a direct statement. These people aren't communications professionals, and boy, does it show. There are so many examples, but the latest one that I noticed was from a study quoted fairly widely about the current record-shattering temperatures in the Western United States. And the study makes one of the stronger statements that we've seen. It says that the temperatures out west are virtually impossible without climate change. But notice they just can't come out and say the climate crisis is causing this, although the truth is that the climate crisis is causing this.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. I mean, the statements are, in fact, very close conceptually, like as a concept. It's the same thing to, on a concept level. It's the same thing to say, A, this is virtually without possible, impossible without climate change, and B, this is climate change. A and B are almost identical statements, but B is so much easier for the average news reader to understand, to say this is climate change, so much easier than virtually impossible without climate change. And that's the least complex of the examples that one could list out. The climatologists often get rather obscure when they're trying to express their level of confidence about whether the hot weather is caused by broader global heating. They're getting obscure about something that's becoming more and more simple in reality, but their communication strategies stay the same.
Yes, they do.
So why is it like this? People who are accustomed to reading and hearing language of a certain complexity, like university academics who read academic journals all day long and function in a university setting all day long, to them, this is normal talk. And I get that way myself sometimes. I work in universities. You can lose track of the difference between a certain academic writing and plain speaking. And weirdly, it takes a little bit of effort to speak plainly, almost like an act of translation. Maybe you've seen this at least yourself when you were working in universities.
All the time. But
scientists have to remember that if you're trying to communicate with normal human beings, the wording matters. The level of clarity needs to be higher. It takes a couple of cognitive steps for a reader or a listener to get from, quote, this is virtually impossible without this, to, quote, this is making this happen, unquote. They're, again, similar conceptually, but rhetorically, they're very different. The first one is qualified. The word virtually is in there. And it's a double negative, impossible without. That wording, impossible without. Think about that. You're making your listener do more work to understand you when you get into word tangles like that. And of course, often people, even pretty attentive people, are kind of reading the news quickly. The plain language goes way farther than that tangle. So climatologists, please learn to make plain statements when you're speaking to the public. Do whatever you have to do to figure this out. Get whoever you can to help you, because people aren't getting it. A large portion of the general public still doubts that heat is caused by global heating. A lot of people are still not connecting heat and global heating. And there's more than one reason. And climatologists aren't the enemy here, but they could be doing better. Climatologists could be doing, I think, a lot better on communication. In case anybody is confused about this example we've been using, the record-setting temperatures that we're seeing all over the West, that's climate change. That is caused by climate change. No qualification. No hedging, no double negatives or tortured grammatical constructions or jargon phrasing. The temperatures in the West are climate change.
You're listening to Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane on Extinction Rebellion Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. And we're talking about a range of topics, including what's happening with our climate crisis. And we're trying to speak truth to power. So a couple of weeks back, we saw protests in Cuba that were the largest protests there in years. You know, as we record this at the beginning of August, they've quieted now. When I look at what seems to have caused them, it looks to me like they were partly brought on by the climate crisis. And let me explain why I think that is. But let's zoom out a bit first. I have to say something about weather, and I have to say something about the Cuban government, and then it will make sense why these protests were climate related. Okay, so let's start first with the weather. As the weather patterns change with too much rain here and not enough rain there, some of the consequences are that deserts expand, crop yields vary more widely, rivers dry up, and so on. And all this happens, as all this happens, people are going to fight over the scarce resources that are left. And it's going to look like a drought caused the fighting. But if climate change caused the drought, then we can say that climate change caused the fighting too. It was just moderated by the drought. Now, society and politics are complicated, and it's rarely just one thing that makes a significant change. We're going to see a lot of cases in the years to come where climate change makes pre-existing tensions worse. The tensions were there before global heating, and then global heating makes them worse. I think Cuba is a good example of that. Now, Cuban politics, background on Cuban politics. You have a communist regime that's not elected and that suppresses most dissent. A revolution that has survived under the pressure of U.S. imperialism with a blockade and embargo that has lasted for more than 50 years. And it's impossible to talk about Cuba and not point out that the United States had put a blockade on Cuba, which it briefly lifted under President Obama, and then President Trump put it right back in. And it's still there now. And that blockade causes a lot of shortages of basic food and supplies. A meat shortage, a scrap shortage, and so on. A lot of things combine to make Cuba what it is. But the limits of freedom, limits on freedom of speech and on political organizing are hugely important. They're too big, really, to ignore. And the United States blockade is also hugely important and too big to ignore. Even with resolute U.S. opposition, Cuba has achieved a lot in terms of human services. For example, very high literacy, very good quality public health. And so assessing the Cuban government is complicated. It's not all bad and pure evil, and it's not all good either. If someone is telling you it's pure evil, they're being simple-minded. Likewise, if someone is telling you it's angelic and wonderful, they're being simple-minded as well. Let's be clear. The Cuban people have been living with this bargain of sorts, or maybe we can call it a balance, serious limits on freedom of speech on the one side, but good health care and high literacy on the other side. Now, I'm simplifying a whole complex society, of course, but basically, after the Castro-led revolution, Cubans got limits on political freedom and got better services than they had before the revolution. It's almost like a bargain. You might even say a social contract. We'll accept this governmental system and we'll get the services it provides. Now, the Castro brothers have died, creating a leadership vacuum, and the political situation is less stable.
And as we seem to be giving a lot of background on this, as Elise and I collaborate on this segment, it's because so many people have quite distorted senses of what is going on with Cuba and what's up with Cuba. And simple-minded explanations often predominate in the general public narrative.
Sure do.
Not always, but often. Now, I'm not an absolute expert on Cuba. I've read a fair bit about it. I've been there. I've talked to people, native Cubans, as well as expats who live there, not in huge numbers, but some, about the situation, and actually seen the soap shortage. So it's from non-expert, but also non-zero actual background that this is coming from. So we have all that background. The Castro brothers have died, creating this leadership vacuum. And there's this kind of social contract between the people continuing with the revolutionary government and the services that it provides. But in the past 12 to 18 months, the coronavirus has strained that health system that was so effective before. And the coronavirus has strained health systems all around the world. Plus, Cuba had to shut down tourism, which was a big source of revenue. And this is coinciding, and here's the climate connection. This is coinciding with a bad sugar harvest. Sugar is Cuba's main crop. Way ahead of tobacco, sugar is the big agricultural industry in Cuba. It has been for a long time. You may also be thinking of rum. Well, rum is just distilled sugar. So Cuban rum is a product of the Cuban sugar industry. From sugar exports and tourism, the Cuban government gets foreign income. And this is the climate connection. And we're getting our information here from Reuters, BBC, and HavanaLive.com. The fields are getting too humid for sugar. High humidity makes a bad sugar crop, and drought makes a bad sugar crop. Drought's going to make a bad crop of almost anything. But the high humidity is particularly devastating to sugar. And that's why sugar is harvested in the least humid times of the year, generally November through April. But now even those months are getting too humid in Cuba for a good crop. They've had droughts for several years now, really back to 2016. So maybe in the past year to two, for the first time, we've got this combination of drought and humidity that's high in the harvest months. And I hope this climate connection is starting to come through now. Temperatures go up, sugar production goes down, and sugar is the big industry. In fact, I say temperatures, it's really humidity, which of course correlates with temperatures, but it's really humidity. So as humidity goes up, sugar production goes down. Sugar is the big industry, so it's less income for a whole lot of people, less tax money for the government to use to function, and people aren't getting by. Again, hot weather means bad sugar crop means bad economy. Add to this the pandemic and the strain on the health system, and some Cubans are saying this government just isn't cutting it. They were enduring some bad things and getting some good things, and now the bad is getting worse, and the good is getting worse too. So even if it's not really the government's fault that the sugar crop failed, even if the broader situation is not really the government's fault, the government becomes the target. So protesting that looked like it was not worth it before starts to look like a better idea. The reasons and the excuses to not protest are vanishing. You might say they're melting. The silver lining are melting. The reasons to tolerate the government are vanishing. It was pretty much stable politically, and then humidity went up. And when humidity went up, it became less stable politically. Think of it as a balance of factors that were mostly balanced. Then humidity weighed on one side, causing that bad sugar crop. Bad sugar threw off that balance. And you get political protests that you haven't seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. Some have said, alternative theory, some have said that the United States is planting or supporting or astroturfing or making or leading those protests, funding those protests. Notably, Rene Gonzalez said that in an interview with Jacobin. Certainly, the U.S. has done things along those lines and much worse in Cuba in the past. Even if that's true this time, though, there's still the question of why the U.S. would have chosen now to do this. And basically, the argument that it's climate connected comes down to whether it's connected to the sugar crop, whether the political change is connected to the sugar crop, because it's weather, it's climate that affected that crop. If the sugar crop had any input into the situation, then we can argue that climate had input into the situation.
Right. And the broader point isn't really about the Cuban government and what it did or didn't do, or what the United States government did or didn't do. The broader point is that the climate crisis is contributing to these protests, maybe even causing these protests, in the sense that the protests would probably not be happening without global heating. Global heating has hurt the sugar crop, and people in Cuba are more desperate than ever. This is an example of political tensions that don't seem climatic on the surface, but when you dig a little deeper, you find the climate crisis is right there in the middle of the story. This is going to happen a lot. There are going to be a lot of things that don't seem caused by global heating, but actually are caused by global heating.
Another country in which this could take place in the foreseeable future is Iran. Iran has been enduring a bad drought for some time now. It seems to be getting worse and worse. There doesn't seem to be an immediate end in sight to the Iranian drought. That's a regime that has mixed popularity with its people. Some are hugely in support of it. Some are less in support of the governmental system in Iran. And I wonder if you're going to start to see a revival of protests in Iran as the situation gets worse and worse with the drought. If so, it's going to be kind of like Cuba in that there's this combination of climate factors and pre-existing political contentions. It's not purely climate, but it's also not innocent of climate effects. There are climate effects going on as well. We could end up seeing that in Iran, as we could in a great many other places. This is Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney on Extinction Rebellion Radio on 99.5 FM WBAI New York. This week, we're talking about the conveyor belt of the Atlantic Ocean and its risk of collapse. We're doing some critique of how climatologists message on the climate crisis, and we're offering a climate perspective on the protests in Cuba. In our last show, we talked about flooding all around the world. We didn't actually talk about Africa. Elise, what's going on in Madagascar?
Well, Madagascar is not suffering from any flooding. It is suffering from one of the worst droughts it's had in 40 years. Now, Madagascar is this island off the coast of Africa, southeast coast of Africa. It's an island nation. And the people there are completely food insecure. More than 400,000 people are facing famine because it just hasn't rained. Now, this is not just a matter of, oh, it hasn't rained, but this is rain that a lack of rain that is the result of climate change. You know, as global temperatures have increased and have affected the monsoons that the country's agriculture depends on for survival, you know, Madagascar has just been thrown into, you know, basic desert conditions. And so the people there are not only food's insecure, but there's a lot of starvation. The food is having to be brought into Madagascar so that the people can survive. And there's no end in sight to this particular drought.
So the monsoons being affected, I guess Madagascar usually gets them and isn't getting them in this case?
Yes, and which is interesting. You think of monsoons as these horrible, scary rains, you know, storms, but it's an important part of maintaining the ecosystem in Madagascar, making sure that people can actually grow food in their land. And so they're not getting those rains and they're not getting anything that's going to help them to survive.
As it is in Southeast Asia, places like Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Indonesia, where they get monsoons and the rains there are coming, as I understand. Sure. But they've always had these huge rains, but they're getting even bigger than they ever were before. And they're causing a level of devastation that the built environment, it wasn't built to accommodate. So another case of unbalanced rainfall, way too much in Southeast Asia, not nearly enough in Madagascar and Southeastern Africa.
Right. And so the rainstorms there, they are flooding the land in ways that make sustaining crops impossible. So on the one hand, you need that balance where the crops aren't being flooded out, but you also need water so that the crops can be sustained. So this is really a horrible situation that's happening in the global south that doesn't get as much attention as, for example, the flooding in Europe.
So we could be seeing lowered crops in places that are getting too much rain, massive flooding, and lowered crops in places that are getting not enough rain, bad drought. I mean, it could be a double whammy in terms of global crop yields. We'll see what happens, but that could happen.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is important when we talk about climate change is it's easy to talk about weather. It's easy to talk about extreme weather conditions, but we really need to talk about food. We really need to talk about fresh water and what the transformation of our ecosystem, our earthly ecosystem, what that's doing to our ability to survive across all parts of this planet. What's happening with in California, for example, where I'm at, you know, we provide a lot of the food, for this country. Mm-hmm. And so as we face drought, this mega drought, that is going to affect the food that's available to you when you go to the supermarket, when you notice that the prices of food are going higher and higher. Well, you can thank climate change for the ways in which it is transforming California and, of course, the rest of the West.
To go back to AMOC in our last minute or so here, the AMOC, that's that conveyor belt system of the Atlantic Ocean that makes that whole Atlantic ecosystem work. What would happen if it shuts down? Well, according to the climatologist that was quoted in the Washington Post, and this is a great case of overqualified and understating the effect, quote, the consequences of a collapse would likely be far-reaching, unquote. So what would this actually be? Of course, same from the same article, this time from the reporter. Quote, if the circulation shuts down, it could bring extreme cold to Europe and parts of North America, raise sea levels along the U.S. East Coast, and disrupt seasonal monsoons that provide water to much of the world, unquote. Boy, it all comes together, doesn't it?
It sure does.
sea level rise along the East Coast of the United States from the AMOC conveyor belt shutting down, as I understand it, would be in addition to sea level rise from a melting Greenland ice sheet.
That's right.
And would be in addition to sea level rise from the melting polar ice caps. I wonder if our models of sea level rise are taking into account all of those things, or if they're just looking at one of them at a time. I fear that it might be the latter.
I fear that it might be the latter as well. And I fear that the scientists will continue to say, well, it's going to be a problem. The sea level rise is going to be rather hard to deal with, or something like that. Something simple that just doesn't get to the just how cataclysmic it's going to be.
We need to tell the truth, Ailes.
Tell the truth.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
Extinction Diaries. Extinction model is the term used for the calculation of time until the death of the last individual of the species in the wild and in captivity. A simple and early extinction model formula was to compare annual birth rates and death rates, but it becomes more complex from there. Advances in science calculated the rate of habitat destruction, pollution, climate change, and in the case of the oceans, the rate of seawater acidification due to warming and other factors. Scientists are also observing resource extraction, like the harvest levels of fish and other marine animals, logging, and general deforestation. Now they factor in body size and energy use, also known as metabolism, to more accurately model and hopefully reveal solutions to slow or stop a species extinction. However, man is notorious for modeling short-sighted, and many species have already disappeared much sooner than modeled. As living members on our planet fall, and in some cases plummet, more and more dedicated scientists and activists engage the greatest challenge on Earth. My name is Mahia Soul, and this is a Small World Radio production.
This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. The Institute of the Black World 21st Century's Black Family Summit proudly announces the Community Cares Listening Line for Black first responders and essential workers. We're here and we're listening. The Community Cares Listening Line is a free, confidential service staffed with responsive volunteers who can provide emotional support and share information with our callers. If you're feeling anxious, afraid, distressed, burdened, or overwhelmed by a range of emotions, please call the Community Cares Listening Line at 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
And people trapped in the justice system are particularly vulnerable to the spread of the coronavirus.
All my people up in Ray Brown. All my people up in Spafford. All my people in the group home.
To On the Count, WBAI's Prison and Criminal Justice Report, Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m., as well as on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. That's right here on listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
This is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot. Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Sangre Soulful Sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio.
Sweet Tuesday.
Summertime is the best time to cool out, but Labor Day marks the unofficial end of summer. So the Harlem Connection's giving you one more chance to cool out by connecting to me, Priest Forever, host of the internet show, The Sunday Cool Out. Catch my Sunday Cool Out vibe on a Friday night with an episode entitled The Harlem Connection to The Sunday Cool Out. Friday, September 3rd at 10 p.m. and Sunday, September 5th at 3 a.m. on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org. And later on demand via WBAI.org/archive.
Easy does it. Do it easy. Push up on it.
And the previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for We Only Want the World with Sansara Taylor. That's coming up real shortly. That is a joint production of WBAI New York and WPFW in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned.